With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Jake Cunningham, and this week we're talking about a film that's had a lot of coverage on film Twitter. In fact, I was reading a scaldingly hot take on it this very morning. The tweet went on and on, linking many tweets together, in fact. Sadly, it has been deleted now, but it has been burnt in my mind to reside forever, like a phantom thread. Hello and welcome to a new guest, Josh Slater-Williams.
Hello, and that was very bad.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And regular Irene Musumeci.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I was better before that.
I thought,
No,
I'm only hanging on by a thread.
Hey, that's good. Oh, this is why I don't invite new guests on. They come in and then they kind of try and up my really good jokes.
They're the voice of truth.
Yeah. So we will be talking about Phantom Thread, Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, all about the kind of glitz and glamour of haute couture making during the 1950s, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. But that's not the only thing we've been watching this week. Josh, what have you been catching up with?
Partially in preparation for this, I've been catching up with some of Mr. Anderson's earlier films, which I've not seen for quite some time, including Magnolia, which I believe you discussed on a previous episode, so I won't get too much into that. But I will say, as much as I really like Phantom Thread and recent PTA, I do sort of miss what I call emo PTA a little bit with Magnolia. That's not quite as present in Boogie Nights, which I've also seen for the first time in about a decade recently, but that's still a pretty astounding piece of filmmaking. But it's also interesting to observe just how different a filmmaker he is in comparison to what he was as this kind of like a wonderkind, I guess, of 90s American indie cinema.
Yeah, well, those two films, Boogie Nights and Magnolia, almost feel like a teenager just being allowed out and given free rein to do whatever he wants, and it feels like those films represent what the inside of his bedroom would look like.
I mean, even if it's a case where he's kind of put away that stage of his career for reasons, obviously, like certain collaborators not being with us anymore, sadly, but seeing Magnolia and Boogie Nights again made me really miss Mellor Walters being in stuff, and Philip Baker Hall's kind of presence in PTA's filmography. I would love if he did work with some of these actors again, but I guess we'll see.
I'd love for William H. Macy to come back.
Yes, definitely.
Always been one of my favourite sort of character actors, but really should be a leading actor.
Yeah, definitely. I think they've just finished up. They've finished Shameless in America now, haven't they?
I believe so. I think I heard that.
So potentially this is the time.
It's the time.
Yeah. Well, I've heard PTA talking that he may actually come back to the present day.
Ooh.
And so perhaps in the next film we can see William H. Macy in the present day doing a Paul Thomas Anderson film. Wouldn't that be a treat? Irene?
I've been watching The Crown Season 2 to my endless shame and embarrassment as a committed non-royalist. But as a recent citizen, I felt that I needed to kind of up my game and find out all about the royal family. And actually, surprisingly, there's quite an overlap in the world of The Crown, both Season 1 and Season 2, with Phantom Thread. So it was really quite a nice way to get into this film, having just watched what's going on with Princess Margaret and catching up with her latest dresses for her appearances in society.
And is this the season that has John Lithgow in?
The first season has John Lithgow in.
Oh, right,
and then
okay.
He's kind of in a few episodes at the beginning, but then it moves on into the 60s.
Okay.
So there's no more Churchill. plenty of Churchill elsewhere in cinemas.
Because this is the third Churchill that we've had on screen in the last 12 months.
Yeah. Lots of Churchill. Can't have enough of him.
I did a nice double bill this week, which when I tell you what it is, I'm sure knowing you two, we could end up discussing the whole podcast on it. So we must reserve our conversation. But it was a lovely double bill. Two nights in a row. Things to Come in Eden.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, so I feel like I have to hold myself back.
Yeah, no, that's what I was worried about.
Special episode of the podcast upcoming.
Yeah, if you have not seen Mia Hansen Loves Films, well, go and watch all of them. But Especially Eden, which it is wonderful. And just as a playlist of music to constantly go back to every time you listen to it for about a week, it's absolutely brilliant. And Things to Come, starring Isabel Huppert as this philosophy teacher caught in this later life crisis and just dealing with it in such a pragmatic and wonderful way. I sent it to my dad, who was a philosophy teacher, and he replied saying, God, it was awful. And some of these conversations that she has to deal with, I don't think I could. But two brilliant films that I will obviously be revisiting many, many times. But those are not the films that we're here to talk about today. We're talking about Phantom Thread, set in the glamour of 1950s post-war London. Reynolds Woodcock, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, and his sister Cyril are at the centre of British fashion. And all is well in the House of Woodcock until our beloved Reynolds stumbles upon the waitress Alma, who is welcomed into his home, into his fashion house, and hilarity ensues.
Also into his heart, you forgot to say.
Yes, he is welcome very much into her heart.
She is. He is. Both
well,
are.
I think hearts
they
are,
both are.
Yeah, they very much share each other's hearts. And this is Daniel Day-Lewis's final film, supposedly. So, Irena, you were tweeting the other day after you'd watched this film that you didn't know what to expect going in, and what you got on the way out was also not what you expected, but it was great.
Totally. I from the trailer, I had a sense of this film that was completely different from what we actually got. I was prepared for a place that the trailer doesn't actually go into, which is a full-blown Hitchcockian psychodrama about obsession and murder at some point and terrible things befalling to women in particular. And I was kind of dreading it, even though I'm a massive PTA fan. And the film really didn't go there the full way. It sort of always has ways in which it could and then doesn't quite. And the film that we got in the end was surprisingly warm, very funny, and quite surprising. I think the word is really surprising. I can't recall a film that I've seen recently that I was excited about in this way and never quite know where it was going to take me.
Yeah, I tried to avoid as much as I could on this. I had seen the trailer, such is the bane of having to work in cinemas. You do see a lot of them. But what's interesting is Paul Thomas Anderson takes control of his trailers. So the trailer that we've seen is the film that he wants us to think we're going to watch. Josh, did you have the same experience?
Somewhat. I mean, when some of the early reviews were coming out, I was obviously hearing the kind of Hitchcock comparisons, but prior to that, the sort of impression I got from the trailer was, I think I described it to myself as Mike Lee's The Red Shoes. It sort of looked like to me in a way, kind of a Mike Lee in more Mr. Turner, topsy-turvy mode, rather than like Secrets and Lies. That sort of reminded me a little bit of that, and just this kind of relationship between arguable muse and not so nice creative force, I suppose. Yeah. It's not quite the film I got, although the thing I found very interesting is that, and I don't think it can be attributed solely to him shooting on film, but it looks so much like British period films made in the 80s. I'm not sure. It's almost like he went back in time in a way. It obviously, it's not set in the same period, but like parts of it in look-wise remind me of things like Chariots of Fire and stuff like that.
Well, I think in his formative years, those are the British films that he would have been watching.
Yeah.
It's funny because I didn't get a vibe of 80s at all. I got a vibe of 50s, which is very much a time period of the story. There's something in his framing that's not very 80s. You're kind of always watching things being half obstructed by stuff. There's always a doorway in the way. There's always a little bit of a window or a curtain. There's some egregious wallpaper in this film, which is utterly fascinating. I love William Morris wallpaper, and there's a load of that in the film. Even the chair that Alma is sitting on at the beginning is a William Morris chair, both the design and the fabric on it. So there's a lot of attention to that detail, which I think is where we see the period drama influence. But the filmmaker that I was reminded of, who is one of PTA's big influences, is Max Ophüls, who is a German-born filmmaker who went to Hollywood in the 30s and then came back to Europe and made most of his greatest films in France in the 50s. And PTA was influenced by particularly his use of tracking shots, but also here in the mise-en-scène, everything is so opulent and luscious and at the same time really minimalistic, which I found absolutely extraordinary. I just couldn't get over how beautiful this film looked and how of its era and of our era at the same time.
Let's get into where the plot of this film starts. Vicky Creeps as Alma is introduced in a wonderful breakfast scene, I think around Whitby was where this was filmed, and Daniel Day-Lewis is Reynolds orders quite a stupendous breakfast, which I tried to recall, which I think is rarebit with a slightly runny egg, bacon, scones with cream, and specifically not strawberry jam.
Raspberry.
And then lapsang tea, and finally sausages.
That is a breakfast after my own heart.
I tried to write it all down. I just gave up and crossed out. I got and some sausages.
Yep.
You'd never be his favourite girlfriend.
No.
Let's face it.
The fact that
why must you remind me of this all?
I'm so sorry.
And so he keeps the little tab of her order, and she remembers all of that and brings it to him. And I think you would fall in love with him if he places that order and you can remember it straight away.
There's also something just so delightful about Daniel Day-Lewis smiling and just being a temporarily happy person. Mm. You sort of remember his earliest roles, and there was some whiff of Newland Archer, his character in The Age of Innocence, who is not a happy man, but is capable of happiness and would be capable. And there was just something so charming about him in that scene. I was really disarmed. But equally, she comes into his life in this kind of, stumbly, a bit awkward way. And she sort of blushes the moment he smiles at her. And you know there's going to be a love story there.
Yeah. So, like sort of awkward meet-cute from a rom-com. Yes. In a way, at first. One note I made is that I'm not sure how you would kind of define this genre-wise, other than drama, I suppose, but I would maybe call it a gothic romantic comedy.
Definitely.
Yeah. That breakfast sort of continues in this really charming way, which he brings him the breakfast and then gives him a note back when he asks for her number, basically. He says, hey, can I take you for dinner? And she gives him a note, and the note says, to the hungry boy, which to me is the absolute key of the entire film. What is he hungry for? And is he a boy or is he a man?
Yeah. That chimes in with his issue that runs throughout the film in his pursuit of his mother and for this this care that he's constantly looking for, whether it's from his sister Cyril, who we will get onto, who is a wonderful creation, and Alma, who's this newly introduced character who will play some motherly caring role for him. So we meet Alma and she becomes a muse quite instantly. He takes her back to her country home and decides that he'd like to make a dress for her, and takes her up this kind of quite ghostly room at the top of the house filled with mannequins and just starts pinning fabric to her. And there's a point where I think we're told how to experience the film, when Daniel Day-Lewis is just holding up these various colours of fabric to her and pins one up and says, no, it's far too serious. And I think that's him saying, you can have fun with this, just because it is Daniel Day-Lewis and because it's Paul Thomas Anderson. This, you don't need to be thinking of this film as to be read completely seriously all the time. You are allowed to enjoy this. Did that come as a surprise?
I expected some comedic moments because they kind of tend to be in even his more serious films like Magnolia, for example. But I think the degree to which I was laughing out loud was somewhat surprising. I mean, some of that might be spoilery to say why I was laughing, but it's based on Day-Lewis's expressions or just laughter at the sheer strangeness this kind of eventually toxic relationship goes down. Mm. It's again, not knowing what this was going to be at all. It was pretty surprising, I suppose.
Well, maybe I'm a bad person because I actually laughed a lot during There Will Be Blood. There are moments there of extreme high comedy in the middle of this very ponderous, very serious allegory about political power and religious power and capitalism. So I did expect that there would be times when, you know, somehow PTA was going to put a stamp on this film that I'd seen trailered and expected to be a Hitchcock drama. And I was kind of thinking, this cannot possibly be what he's doing. It's interesting. What I was talking about Max Oldfield's earlier is also that I got a whiff of Todd Haynes. I kept thinking this could be a Todd Haynes film. If only it weren't so mad. It's got that PTA level madness in the dialogue and also in the places where the relationship is eventually taken, which is a way of sending itself up. And that's fantastic. And it really, to me, does connect to this idea of what it's trying to do with this central male character and sending him up and sending up the idea of toxic masculinity. How do you deal with this? I don't particularly like the idea of any woman being a muse. I think the muse sits there and is admired and loved, and that's not what Alma does. In this initial scene where it's kind of very seductive what he's doing to her, he asks her to undress and she's practically, you know, as naked as you could be in the 50s without being butt naked. And he's taking her measurements and suddenly he's calling up his sister to take up her measurements. Mm-hmm. That is such a bizarre thing to do. And I did not expect that moment of seduction to turn into this, you know, message, which is his way of seducing her is to make things for her. However, she responds to this in a way that is fascinating. He sees her in a way that she doesn't see herself, but eventually comes to inhabit. And it's a very empowering way to be. She holds the reins of power throughout the film eventually. And the relationship with Cyril is also quite interesting, how that triangle is set up from the very beginning and everyone's got very clear roles. So I think the comedy really fits into that and it plays a very significant part in how we should interpret the film. You know, kind of it's constantly trying to send itself up and to tell you this is not.
Well, Josh, you meant you called it a gothic romantic comedy, and the film that I was thinking about whilst watching this was The Handmaiden.
I can see that, yeah.
And I think, and looking at that, it kind of taking elements of the gothic and putting them into the film and having them as normal, but taking other elements and reworking them and adapting them. Like this idea of this kind of this house that we never see the end of, that it's always with these rooms that just appear and these little secret messages that get left inside the clothing, which is such a wonderful detail. And it's using it to actually deconstruct that power balance that we're used to seeing in this triangle between a man and a woman and a woman. And I really wasn't sure from the beginning what the power balance was for quite a while, because you're convinced it's Cyril who's pulling all the strings. And as it goes along, you think, no, it's him. And as it goes along, maybe it's Alma, maybe it's everyone. And you have so much fun going along with that ride. Just as I think you do with The Handmaiden as well, which is constantly keeping you guessing.
The other great joy of the film is that it's...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Also, as well as all of these things, a gothic comedy, a drama, a melodrama in that kind of Todd Haynes way and Max Oldfield's, it is also a great screwball comedy. The dialogue is written entirely like, you know, the great screwballs of the 1930s. Bringing Up Baby is one that comes to mind. And it works with that same setup. It's two people who are completely bonkers and are intolerable to anyone else who actually find each other in some bizarre way. Mm. So that works incredibly well in the setup.
I was going to say, one of my favourite quotes, and perfectly appropriate since we're recording this in the morning, was, I cannot begin my day with a confrontation, please.
That is brilliant. I did love all the breakfast scenes. Also, as someone who is utterly religious about breakfast, I completely agree. Do not upset me at breakfast, please.
This film is almost as much about breakfast as it is clothes. Should we maybe discuss a bit about Leslie Manville's Cyril before we kind of delve into where the plot goes?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So this is a now Oscar-nominated performance for supporting actor from Leslie Manville, a thoroughly well-deserved one.
Yeah, it's a role that, again, with some of the Hitchcock influence, at first kind of seems very much in the spirit of, well, I guess it's also the spirit of Daphne du Maurier's novel as well, but Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca, with the Mrs. Danvers? Mrs. Danvers, yes. I was going to say Miss Havisham, that's completely weird. Mrs. Danvers' character is this kind of person you get with the package that the lead character Rebecca finds with her marriage, kind of seemingly pulling the strings and manipulating everything. It initially seems like that. She's the sister of Daniel Day-Lewis's fantastically named Reynolds Jeremiah Woodcock.
Which was a name that they came up with to give him a silly name when they hadn't decided on his name. And then it just stuck.
Oh, well.
The silly bit being Jeremiah, of course.
Yes, that's one of the great last ones revealed during the wedding ceremony. But, but yes, she kind of, her and Reynolds kind of built this business up together. And yeah, she just pretty much comes with the package. But one thing I found interesting is that she may initially seem like sort of an antagonist, I suppose, but various points, I think you can read that things she professes to like Reynolds, like, oh, I rather like Alma. Maybe she does actually mean it. Mm. I think it's not quite as cut and dry as I maybe might have expected from the comparisons to Danvers I'd seen in some of the critical reception. I don't know what you guys think about that.
I think she does like her. I think there's a point at which the film turns, and is where we're going to get into the scene that leads up to the evil asparagus being cooked in butter, which is clearly a totally common thing to do. In that moment, that's the moment when Alma kind of starts to appear to be more powerful. She starts to make requests and says, this is what I want. But actually, it's a moment of real weakness, I think, for her as a character, to have to say it out loud and to have to architect a scene and a time where she can be alone with him. Except, how else are you going to do it? These people are around all the time, all the seamstresses and the dressmakers and the people who come to the house to work. And the sister is there at all times, at breakfast, at lunch, at dinner, at work. When they go to sleep, they sleep in separate rooms. How are you going to get rid of this person? And yet, that's the moment when Cyril really gives her advice and says, look, he doesn't like surprises. Do not do this. Mm. This is a bad idea, girl. I want to keep you here. I want to keep you safe. And she goes, no, I'm going to do this. And that's the moment when I thought, oh, God, everything's going to go pear-shaped now. He's just going to kill her. Mm. And he doesn't, and then magical things happen. So I do think that Cyril is kind of overall in favor of Alma generally. She gets quite late at the point where she says, should I ask her to leave? Which we see her do at the very beginning. So clearly she's in charge of getting the girlfriends to leave when they get a bit too much. But we only see one other woman in Reynolds' life who is a person who clearly doesn't really get him and is there just begging for his attention and his love, and that's not worked. So I think Cyril's trying to warn Alma in a way, but Alma's going to have her way, absolutely. What's also quite interesting is the historical accuracy of having a brother and sister team lead a fashion house. This was a part of the extensive research that the team did for the film. They worked apparently from a biography about Cristobal Balenciaga, who is one of the great designers, influenced all of the great fashion houses of the 50s. And there are clear references to the fact that it was always a male-female team. So she's also a woman in extreme power in terms of her business position and being the person who contacts the clients and deals with the clients, while the crazy guy is upstairs designing the dress and then doing the crazy bit that he does. So she's a fascinating character and a great performance. She's so subtle. She doesn't have as many lines as anyone else, but her face is a work of wonder. I just was so enthralled by watching her.
I think Anderson knows that because there are a few shots in the film that are just very much close-ups of her looking directly into camera as well, quite early on in the film.
Yeah.
And I think in this, he's really valuing people's faces, even when they're not saying a thing, just resting the camera and leaving it on them a bit longer than we might expect.
There were a couple of moments of that where I was half expecting her eyes to change, like Amy Adams in The Master. it's a terrific performance. And again, when she does very occasionally, you know, go into not even a speech, but just a couple of small quips, it's like a bulldozer even goes through her... her see you next Tuesday of her brother trying to act up.
Yes. There is a particular insult that when he is trying to kind of step over the line, she completely shuts him down with a breakfast time insult. And at that moment, you realise he's really at the bottom of this food chain.
That is definitely going to be Manville's Oscar clip. Yeah. Definitely.
A point that I was not expecting the film to go into, and one that I'm sure Arena and I can agree on as the anti-mushroom brigade of this podcast, is...
I am also anti-mushroom.
Really?
Yes.
I'm not...
Yes.
I'll begrudgingly have them.
Oh, We're taking over.
Yes.
I'm very allergic to mushrooms, so now you know how to kill me.
Excellent. Well, I'm hoping this is kind of... this is spreading out, because we had The Beguiled as well, and now we've got this, and I'm hoping lots of American auteurs gradually telling each other... Just don't do mushrooms, all right? Just have enough. And gradually that's going to start spreading, and like Michael Bay's going to do it, and then it's going to be in Marvel films, and then no one's going to have to eat mushrooms anymore.
Mushroom man!
Yeah. So were we expecting poison mushrooms in this film?
I was, only for the reason that someone blatantly spoiled it on Twitter the day before I saw the film. However,
so
I was under the vague hint I got was that maybe Reynolds gets poisoned, not my mushrooms, but gets poisoned right at the end of the film and dies or something like that. So I had that in the back of my mind going into the film. I'm very pleased that's not quite where it was. It was a lot weirder than I expected.
Yeah, this is a moment in which Alma grates some poisonous mushrooms into Reynolds' beloved Lapsang tea, kind of forcing him to bed. And I think there's this idea of men wanting constantly to go to work, that you can't be ill, that you have to be at work all the time and you have to provide. And he goes down to check on this wedding dress that he's been making, and the kind of dizzying camera just follows him around, and you kind of get into his headspace. It's really woozy, and you can really feel his discomfort in the way that it's been shot. And he's just surrounded by these women that are dressed the same, and there's this dress in the middle. And it's this kind of horrible nightmare for him that he's out of control of the situation and collapses and tears and stains the dress that he's been working on. And for him, this is the worst situation possible, that he is told to be sent to bed, that he cannot work. And this is all Helm was doing.
He is truly rendered powerless by a woman. And I mean, I at one point when they pick the mushrooms the first time, I thought, I wonder what they're doing with these mushrooms. And then, you know, how the idea comes back to her. And then obviously it comes back this one time when she puts the mushrooms in the tea. But eventually it comes up again at the end as essentially the thing that seals a deal between them, which is a way of, you know, her making her desire very explicit. She says, I want you powerless, flat out in a bed, and you cannot do anything without my care. And that, I mean, short of 50 Shades of Grey, I don't think an S&M contract has ever been made more explicit.
Misery. Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's a really good call. Poison, of course, traditionally is a woman's weapon, as famously poised by Sherlock Holmes. But it's always this kind of complicated way for women to get their revenge, from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs to Game of Thrones and, of course, Hitchcock. Notorious has the mother and husband poisoning the wife. Suspicion is the great one about the husband poisoning the wife. And here it's fantastic to see poison going back to women and just this great weapon of power.
Yeah. And he has a great romantic line at almost closing the film when he says, kiss me, my darling, before I'm ill.
And then cut to him sat on a stool next to the toilet.
Yeah.
With vomit bowl.
I think it would be better if you left now.
And then come back. Yeah. I wonder how long he's going to survive.
Yeah.
Like, surely at one point, it might just be too much.
Yeah. How long? Like, I wonder whether the time frame between poisonings is gradually just going to get shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
That maybe this time it was a few months and then she might just get a bit annoyed and just give him a weekend eventually.
I did not realise by the point of that closing scene how much, whether he knew or not, that he was being poisoned. And then by the end, it's completely sealed. That's how they're going to do it. That's how it's going to operate. Occasionally, he just needs to be told to shut up and go away somewhere. And that is fantastic. Mm-hmm. The way to deal with toxic masculinity is with poison. Mm-hmm. You just make it, you know, completely harmless by taking away its power.
Mm. So something that goes throughout the film, and maybe a bit differently to Inherent Vice, is Johnny Greenwood's music. Now, in Inherent Vice, that's kind of, it's dipped in, because that film is very much got its own soundtrack as well as its score. This is completely reliant on Johnny Greenwood's score, which feels like such a big presence. It's very grand, it's kind of intoxicating. Josh, you and I were both listening to it on the way here.
Yes.
It's quite easy to listen to, which maybe is quite a bit different to something like the There Will Be Blood score.
Yeah, well, I also think it does share lineage with that, and that's it makes that it's both a very lush kind of fitting what's more the topical focus of this film, but it's also still very eerie throughout, which kind of is perfectly appropriate for kind of the sealed universe that is this household in a way. But yeah, I figured that's fantastic, yeah, listening on its own as well, but brilliant in the film itself.
So. Yeah, and the first working track from it was actually a leftover from Inherent Vice.
Oh, right.
So that a little bit of that Inherent Vice score eventually became the Phantom Thread score that we know now. And something that I was really surprised about is that the Academy Award nominations came out and Johnny Greenwood was nominated. And this is the first time that he has been. And you think of how acclaimed the music for There Will Be Blood and The Master Inherent Vice has been, that this is the first time that he's been nominated, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, There Will Be Blood might have been disqualified for once some stupid technical reason, like he possibly reused a bit of his score from Body Song way back.
Right, okay.
Something... They seem to be very picky regarding whether they bother with that, because I think the same thing was thrown at Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross for The Social Network, yet they still won an Oscar. Mm. So,
yeah. It's quite romantic, the music, and the track Alma, the track when she's first introduced, which comes a bit later in the soundtrack when you're listening to it, the sound really changes. And when she's not there, you can really feel it in the music, in quite an obvious way. It almost goes Giacchino lost in terms of how kind of rapturous it is for her, and that he is so in love with her presence on screen, and you totally get swept back into this world. And I think that shows you just how much a part of the film this music is, which I think compared to something like Inherent Vice is not so integral.
It's really nice how the music goes along with the lighting as well. There's the lighting and the colors in the film change when Alma is introduced, and they change at that point when he's trying the different colors on her and says, no, this one's too serious. Up until the moment, it's been very blue, it's been very cool. There's a lot of winter light. It's definitely a very wintry film for me in terms of lighting. Although it's quite bright, but in that kind of cold, you know, harsh white and blue lighting. And then when she's finally introduced in the picture and he selects this kind of warm red color, then completely different hues come in, and the music does go along with that as well. I think there's this beautiful combination.
One thing to just quickly bring up there, because I'm not sure if we did, this is Paul Thomas Anderson's first film where he's acted as cinematographer.
This is something that I thought was quite interesting, because there's no credit for cinematography on the film, and he said that he shot it himself but wouldn't call himself the cinematographer or director of photography, because he effectively placed the camera, but he doesn't know how to work it, and so he just said that this is a collaborative effort. And I think what's different about this to me is this reads as being really agile, that I don't think I've really seen in a film of his before. Like Magnolia, for instance, is so composed, all of that dollying all the time. It's amazing to look at, and it's got such a lovely flow to it, but it's very composed. And I imagine he took a lot of time and care to get the look he wanted on this, but it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
It feels like you're just like lovingly tossed into it and you're just dreaming with it.
Yeah, it's also maybe from the 70mm film that he used, but there's this kind of rarefied way of lighting which reminded me of Vermeer. The visual comparison for me was entirely with Vermeer. There's one source of light, and then suddenly the key aspects of the picture are lit by that one light. And this happens time and time again, which is extraordinary. I bet he worked with a lot of natural light as well, because the whole film was shot in this house in Fitzroy Square, which has all of the kind of embassy buildings in it. And there's a lot of beautiful light in there, lots of space. And
let's go afterwards.
Yeah.
For a cup of lapsang.
Right, so that's it on our Phantom Thread podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. If you need something else to watch, because there are other films, but frankly, what are you going to watch, really?
What are you talking
Eden.
About?
Let's just go back and watch Eden again. If you haven't seen it yet, God's Own Country is now on Curzon Home Cinema. So if you want to check that out, it played in cinemas for months and months last year. It's a hit at the UK box office. It's got biffers. It's got BAFTA nominations.
It was in the Curzon top 10.
Yeah, you've got to check it out. You really do. I was lucky enough to speak to Alex Carreanu and Francis Lee all about it on an old episode of the show. So go back and listen to that if you want to. But what a double bill you could do this week. Phantom Thread in the cinema and God's Own Country at home. Wonderful stuff. If you've got any thoughts on Phantom Thread, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com, and we will be reading them out on next week's show. And if you haven't already, do review us. So head to iTunes or SoundCloud, subscribe if you haven't already, leave a review, comment, give us that rating out of 5 stars. That would be wonderful. Until next time, though, it is goodbye from Josh.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Arena.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.